Chapter 18. "Tell me again why we're going to Casablanca," Kate said. "He could have waited and gotten to us here in the inn, just like he got to Professor Lewis."
"Because Morocco may be just across the Straits of Gibraltar," Quentin said. "But it's the best place in the world to disappear. Or to make people disappear."
"That may be his plan," Nick said. "Doesn't mean it's going to work."
"What's our plan?" Jake asked. "We can't just walk into Edgar's trap. We'll never leave."
"I'm working on an angle," Nick said. "In the meantime, we better get going. I don't imagine the professor's enjoying his little vacation."
"This is not the way I wanted to go to Casablanca," Kate said. "I'd rather walk into Rick's cafe, see if Sam is playing the piano."
They all piled into the van and drove back across Slovakia, through Bratislava and into Austria. As they were approaching the Vienna airport, Kate took out her passport and looked at it.
"As soon as they scan this," she said, "I'm going to be detained. We're all going to be detained."
"It's not going to be a problem," Nick said. He'd been texting on his phone for most of the drive.
"There was already an Interpol red notice on Quentin," she said. "By now there might be one on all of us."
"I have it covered," Nick said.
When they arrived at the airport, Nick asked Jake to pull over so he could drive. With Nick behind the wheel, they drove past the commercial terminals to a special security gate. Nick gave the guard a name that nobody else in the vehicle recognized.
"I haven't used that name in years," Nick said as he drove onto the tarmac, heading toward a Dassault Falcon jet.
The door to the jet pivoted open, and Captain Duckworth came down the stairs.
"How the hell did you get here?" Quentin asked, giving him a bro hug.
"Easy on the ribs," Duckworth said. "I'm still on the mend. But when your son sent me an SOS, I figured I needed to come myself."
"Thanks, Captain," Nick said, shaking his head. "I didn't know who else we could trust right now."
"I've already met Kate," Duckworth said, taking her hand. "She came to give me a hard time in the hospital."
"Sorry about that," Kate said.
"Don't be," Duckworth said. "It was the highlight of my week."
"Are you sure you should be out of that bed already?" she asked.
"It's not exactly the recovery plan my surgeon recommended," Duckworth said. "But as long as I don't get shot again, I should be all right."
"This is my father," she said, "Jake O'Hare."
Duckworth looked Jake up and down as he shook his hand.
"Former Marine, am I right?"
"Nothing former about Semper Fi," Jake said.
"Man after my own heart. I'm glad to meet you."
"Let's get on that plane," Nick said to Duckworth. "We have to get to Casablanca, and we do have a few stories to tell you on the way."
It was a 3-hour flight from Vienna to Casablanca, on a private jet that under any other circumstances would have felt like luxury. Kate stared out the window as they passed over northern Italy, and then the blue water of the Mediterranean. Nick sat next to her as Quentin told Duckworth about everything that had happened to them, and Jake bonded with Duckworth over a lifetime of military and extra-military adventures.
"We were so preoccupied with finding that gold," Kate said to Nick. "I admit it. I got caught up in the search as much as anyone. But right now I only care about 2 things.
"What's that?" Nick asked.
"Getting the professor back," Kate said, "and taking down Edgar."
Nick nodded.
"Sounds like a plan. And then we can all go home."
Nick nodded again, thought about it, and said,
"Unless that book really can lead us to where the gold is now."
They both looked over at Quentin, who had the logbook out. The 3 older men were poring over each page.
"It's just dates and amounts," Duckworth said, wearing reading glasses and carefully examining each page.
When he got to the last page, he picked up the book and read the words carefully, angling the page for better light.
"My German isn't great, and this handwriting is pretty rough. But the very first word here is Verrat, betrayal."
"I knew it," Quentin said. "Gehring trapped him in that tunnel."
"The next couple of sentences," Duckworth went on,
He's got something here about Descartes, the map, and the uber-legionaire intellect, the superior intellect of the man who might follow it.
Then what's this?
Duckworth looked over his glasses at the faded words that came next.
Is this Tief Brunnen?
I'm not sure what that means. Brunnen is like a fountain or a well, something that holds water. But all the rest of this, it's basically just him feeling sorry for himself because he's trapped in a tunnel and he'll never get to see the Third Reich become what it's supposed to be. Ein Land der Verheißung und Erfüllung. Land of promise and fulfillment. The usual Nazi twaddle we fought a war to bury forever.
Amen to that, Jake said. My own grandfather fought that war. His destroyer went down in the Java Sea.
Mine too, Duckworth said, looking up at him. Shot down over Berlin. My grandmother gave birth to my father the day after she got the telegram.
Duckworth paused a moment, looking at the handwriting in the book.
The man you're going to see today, he finally said, he's the grandson of this Nazi.
He is.
Do me a favor, and kick in his teeth for me.
The sun was still high in the afternoon sky when they landed in Casablanca. Duckworth slipped some money into one official's waiting palm at the airport, then two more, and then they were out of the airport through the private exit, having never shown a passport to anyone.
They may already be watching you, Duckworth said. I'm going to leave you on your own now.
Where did they say to meet you?
Southeastern side of town, Quentin said. A place called Moulay Rashid.
Duckworth winced.
I'll try to watch your back, but this is a tough city to keep tabs on someone.
They stood on the sidewalk for a minute, drawing stares. Jake raised a hand to hail a taxi, and a car screeched to a sudden halt. It was too small, too loud, and the tires could barely be called round anymore. Everyone squeezed in, and Quentin gave the driver the address, written down on a piece of paper. The driver gave the paper back, shaking his head and saying something emphatic that nobody could understand. Quentin returned the paper with 20 euros on top. It went back and forth like this for a few more beats until finally the money was enough, and the driver pulled out into the heavy afternoon traffic.
Just how big a favor did Captain Duckworth owe you? Jake asked Quentin.
Quentin shrugged.
I may have saved his life once.
The conversation was cut off when the taxi driver nearly ran over a man on a scooter. Many harsh words were exchanged in Arabic. Then the driver went another 100 yards before nearly committing another vehicular homicide. The taxi worked its way slowly through the heart of the city. Carts on crowded sidewalks sold food, clothing, and knockoff American movies. Kate started to feel a little sick, sitting in the middle of the brick hard back seat as the car hit every pothole in the streets. The buildings got smaller and the streets got even rougher. Finally, the taxi stopped and they all piled out. Kate's feet were barely on the ground when the taxi spun its wheels and fishtailed away from them. They were in a small market square. It was empty, but the smell of fried fish hung thick in the air. Dogs barked. Faces looked at them through open windows, and then the shutters were loudly slammed shut. Nick looked up and down the deserted street. This place could use a Starbucks. A man dressed in desert camo approached them. On his head was a classic German officer's hat with goggles on the brim, like something Field Marshal Rommel would have worn. Standing next to him was Franz. His left eye was still hidden behind a black patch, but now he was also missing part of his right ear.
My name is Rolf, the first man said. If you will all come with me, your transport is waiting.
Where's Professor Lewis? Nick asked.
You will see him soon, Rolf said.
I want to see him now, Nick said, or else speak to him on the phone.
You are wasting time, when we could already be on our way.
Nick looked at the rest of the team.
Guess we're taking a road trip, he said.
Rolf gestured toward a nearby alley. The team approached it warily. When they turned the corner,
they saw a windowless panel truck with the rear door open.
"We're not getting in that thing," Nick said.
Rolf drew an H&K semi-automatic from his belt, put the barrel in Kate's back.
"I believe you are."
The outside world slipped away, replaced by the two simple elements of heat and motion. Nick, Kate, Jake, and Quentin sat on the hard metal floor, drawing breath inside a furnace as it bounced its way down the roads of Morocco. The sounds of the city grew quieter and finally faded away. The air became a slightly less punishing degree of hot, and the thin bands of light running across the imperfect seams in the metal grew dimmer. Kate and Nick slept for a while, their heads leaning together against the wall of the truck. They were jarred awake when the truck came to an abrupt stop. The rear door was thrown open and cool air rushed in. It was one of the best things Kate had ever felt. They all climbed out of the truck and looked around at a small desert outpost, just a gas station and two other buildings. There was nothing else but the open desert all around them, a mostly dark sky, and a billion stars starting to shine. Franz unfolded himself from the cab, stretched his muscles, and went to pump the gas.
"Two at a time," Rolf said, nodding toward the building. "Use the bathroom. Drink some water. Do anything else, and the two people left behind will die."
Kate drank as much water as she could, breathed in the cool air until it was time to go back into the truck. The warmth of the day had vanished, and now she started to shiver.
"The sun went down to our right," Quentin said. "We're heading south."
Time went into limbo again. The gaps in the truck's metallic sides started to glow with light again. The air quickly got warmer. They felt the truck come to a stop. Then they heard muffled voices arguing. The truck started moving again.
"I don't think we're in Morocco anymore," Quentin said. "We've come so far south. That was probably the border."
"The border to where?" Kate asked.
"Essentially nowhere," Quentin said. "The biggest no man's land in the world."
Jake nodded. "Western Sahara."
"That's right," Quentin said. "Morocco has claimed it ever since it was a Spanish colony. But the local desert nomads are called the Sahrawi. They've been here for centuries, and they're claiming the land for their own independent country."
"How do you know so much about it?" Nick asked.
"It was on the agency's radar for a while," Quentin said. "If there was oil involved, or really anything at all except empty sand dunes, they might have cared a little more."
The road beneath the truck's wheels turned into hard, rutted ground. They bounced up and down like popcorn in a popper for at least another hour, until finally everything stopped. The door was thrown open. Kate winced at the sudden glare of morning sunlight.
"Welcome to the Citadel," Rolf said. "Herr Egger is anxious to see you."
"Where's Professor Lewis?" Nick asked.
"He is inside. Come."
They got out, all stumbling as they found their legs again after so many hours in the truck. As they blinked away the glare, they saw a compound made up of white single-story buildings. Each one looked like it had been baking in the sun for centuries. Beyond the buildings, as far as the eye could see in any direction, was nothing but endless sand, swept into dunes by the wind. Aside from the beat-up panel truck, there were a handful of other large vehicles, all equipped with large tires for desert travel. A dozen men, all wearing desert camo, stood watching as Rolf led his hostages into the largest of the buildings.
"These men are different," Nick thought. "They're dressed in real uniforms. They look sharper, more disciplined. And I haven't seen one Red Star tattoo yet, which means this isn't a bunch of hired goons. This is the real thing. The Brotherhood."
"This way," Rolf said. He opened two hulking doors that looked like they'd come off Noah's Ark, leading to a large, mostly empty hall. High windows ran down both long walls in the hall. The floor was once intricate tiles, now cracked with age and covered with a light dusting of sand. At the opposite end was a great wooden table, also probably from the Ark, set upon a dais, which was shared by a pair of camo-wearing, submachine-gun-toting guards who served as bookends to the table. Seated behind the center of the table, like a desert king receiving visitors, was Klaus Agar.
"How was the journey?" Agar asked.
"The nuts weren't warm, and the champagne was flat," Nick said. "I want to see Professor Lewis."
"We've had some interesting conversations, your professor and I. It's amazing how much he knows about German literature, and yet so little about the German soul."
"I'm not sure your soul represents the best of modern-day Germany," Nick said. "Where is the professor?" Agar just smiled. Franz, who'd been standing at the back of the room with Rolf, came up behind Quentin and picked him up by the back of his neck. Jake aimed a kick at Franz's knee. It would have folded any other man in half, but Franz just looked down at Jake as if to say, "You're next."
"The book," Agar said.
Holding Quentin in the air with one hand, Franz searched him with the other. The logbook was tucked into Quentin's belt. Franz took it, dropped Quentin to the hard floor, and brought the book to Agar.
"Thank you, Franz," Agar said. Franz nodded without saying a word.
Jake and Nick helped Quentin get to his feet as Agar paged through the book.
"Just to be clear," Agar said, "Adolf Hitler was a drug-addled fool, easily manipulated by men like Heinrich Himmler."
"Hitler, Himmler, Goering," Jake said. "Nobody cares about them anymore, Agar. They all hanged. At least the ones who didn't kill themselves to avoid it. The world's got bigger problems right now, and it doesn't need you running around here playing Nazi dress-up, trying to find some gold your grandfather helped steal."
Franz took a step toward Jake.
"Stop," Agar said.
"Silence."
Franz froze in his tracks. Everybody looked at Agar as he put the book down on the table and bent over to carefully read the last page.
"He wrote this," Agar said, transfixed, "with his own hand. These are the last words of Gerhard Agar."
"Hate to tell you," Nick said, "but your grandpa Gerhard had a pretty rough exit."
"I said silence!"
Agar looked carefully at the page, saying the first word out loud.
"Verrat."
"Betrayal." He took a moment to absorb this, then kept reading, mouthing each word to himself as he went down the page.
"What does this mean?" he said. "Tiefbrunnen vom Eisenmann. Tiefbrunnen vom Eisenmann."
He kept saying it to himself over and over again, like a man in a trance, until at last, Agar looked up at the ceiling, raising his hands as if receiving a benediction from God himself.
"Danke, mein Gerhard," he said. "Danke."
"We kept our end of the bargain," Kate said. "Now give us back Professor Lewis." When Agar came back to Earth, he looked down at Kate as if she were a child interrupting serious grown-up business.
"You're going to watch your professor die now," Agar said. "Along with the rest of these men. Then I'm going to let my brothers use you for their own amusement."
Jake and Nick both took two steps toward Agar, and were stopped only when the guards pointed their guns at Kate.
"Take them to the box," Agar said. "I want to watch how they die. Every minute of it. Don't start until I'm there."
As they were all led outside, Kate squinted in the harsh light, then looked one by one at Nick, Quentin, and finally her father. Behind them were the two guards with their submachine guns, Rolf with his semi-automatic, and Franz, who never really needed a gun at all.
"If anybody's got a great idea," Kate said,
"now would be the perfect time to share it."